The first time I read the book of Revelation, I've got to admit that I found it more than a little confusing. I mean, no question, it was very compelling reading. But what in the world did all those symbols mean? You've got beasts coming out of the sea, vials full of God's wrath, and seven churches that seem to be more than churches. What exactly is the author's point? Today on Disclosure, we're going to get our chance to ask him. If bending the space-time continuum was actually a possibility and you could visit any period of Earth's history you wanted, where do you think you'd go? I mean, think about the possibilities. What time period would you choose? Personally, I've always wished I could go back to visit the 18th century and maybe sit down with a guy like Thomas Jefferson or James Madison or Benjamin Franklin. Or going back just a little bit further, I'd love to actually be there when Martin Luther takes a deep breath, musters up his courage, and marches down to the church door in Wittenberg to launch the Protestant Reformation. Wouldn't you love to be there when Gutenberg prints the first book on the first printing press? Or when Columbus comes back from the New World and gives his report to the royal family of Spain? What about Marco Polo, or Amerigo Vespucci, or Thomas Aquinas, or Napoleon, or Henry VIII? I mean, just think about the possibilities. Did these people really understand the impact of what they were doing? Did they understand that you and I would still be talking about them today, that they were shaping world thought and world history? What if you could go back and visit the people who changed the world the most? What if you could actually visit the people God used to write the Bible itself? And what if you could meet the author of the book of Revelation? Well, to be honest, I really haven't figured out how to bend the space-time continuum. But today I've got the next best thing. Believe it or not, thanks to my good friend, Colonel Dick Stenbakken, I've invited John the Revelator to join me on the program, and I'm going to let him tell us why he wrote the book and what we're supposed to learn. I don't think you'll have ever seen a program quite like this. But just before we get to that, it's time now for the Bible in the News. You might not have noticed it underneath stories like Trayvon Martin or the open mic incident in South Korea, but there's been quite a bit of flap about Dick Cheney's recent heart transplant. Apparently, some people think that because he's 71 years old, but he served as vice president of the United States, he probably got preferential treatment, that his new heart probably should have gone to someone else. And when they say someone else, they usually mean someone much younger. Now, personally, I don't know how in the world you calculate the worth of one human being over another. But for the most part, I'm glad I don't have to make those kinds of decisions. You'll notice that the doctors are being very careful this week to reassure the public that the selection process is very fair and very rigorous, and that the former vice president didn't leapfrog the system, as one heart specialist put it. They're reminding us that sometimes septuagenarians live long, productive years after getting that new heart. And of course, it's also possible that younger people could utterly waste a second chance at life. Now, I don't really want to weigh in on the merits of Dick Cheney's individual case, because that's not really what I'm driving at. What I do want to talk about is the general bias towards youth in Western culture. While former generations used to venerate gray hair and experience, we seem to think that youth is where it's at. Now, of course, good parents tend to favor their children over themselves, but that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the general cultural bias we have that worships the young and inexperienced. We spend billions of dollars, after all, every single year on cosmetics and surgery to try and convince the world that we're still in our 20s or 30s. And of course, all that's to no avail, because you just can't cheat the wages of sin. Now, on a personal note, as a minister and as an evangelist, I do feel compelled to mention that a bias towards youth sometimes rears its head even in the pews of our churches. I mean, naturally, we want the next generation to love Christ and to carry the torch of faith into the future if Jesus doesn't return. We want our kids to love the Lord and raise their own families in an environment of faith. We want them to have the hope that we have. So obviously, it's important to stress reaching our young people with the gospel. But you know, sometimes, when I listen to discussions about outreach or evangelism, I wonder if we're not stressing youth to the exclusion of other people. Sometimes. There seems to be a bias, sometimes, that suggests that winning youth is our most important objective. And of course, it is important. But as someone who was recently considered a youth myself, as someone who came to Christ in his early 20s, I do want to ask, how do you weigh the value of one soul over another? And where in the biblical record does Jesus suggest we niche market the gospel? I mean, it does happen, of course. And there's no question that some people have a gift for certain segments of the population. Paul, after all, was the apostle to the Gentiles. It was a niche market. But if you read the Gospels carefully, you'll notice that the most important niche for outreach isn't young or old. It isn't male or female. The most important niche is sinners. And that's a group you find absolutely everywhere. By all means, if God has gifted you for reaching a certain segment of the population, if you have a special gift for young people, then go and tell them about Jesus. Give it all you've got. Pour yourself into it. But always bear in mind that as a whole, the church needs to remember who the book of Revelation says the real audience is. It's every nation, tribe, tongue, and people. Now, I hope you've got your Bible handy because I'm about to sit down with John the Revelator for a behind-the-scenes look at the book that takes us behind the scenes in God's universe. And yes, you heard me right. My guest today is John the Revelator, and I'll be back in just a minute. Today, I've got a pretty unusual guest. And I'm not quite sure this has ever happened on Hope Channel before. John the Apostle, the author of the book of Revelation, has agreed to sit down and tell us more about his life in the actual presence of Jesus. John, I'm so delighted that you've joined me for a little bit of time today. And I've got to say, I have read your stuff for years and I've always wanted to meet you. I mean, I have got so many questions I want to ask you. You don't mind if I spend a little time asking questions, do you?
No, I'm glad to be here. But tell me about all these lights. See, on Patmos, all we had were things like this. These little oil lamps.
Right.
It must take a lot of olives to make this much oil.
Well, you know, some of it does run on oil. This might come as a surprise to you, but we dig down sometimes miles into the earth and find oil buried deep down. Not olive oil, other oil, and we burn it for energy.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. A little bit of a different world than where you were. But you had these lamps here.
Well, and see, that's, Sean, what it's about. It's about light. See, and Jesus is the light of the world. And we're like these lamps. We need to shine and bring the light of the world wherever we are.
Well, before we get into your life story and some of what's in Revelation, tell me a little bit about these lamps that you've brought along. This one that you're holding has got a face on it, and it's got a couple of holes, and naturally quite unlike the lamps that we've got here overhead in the Hope Channel studios.
Well, this lamp came out of a Roman pagan temple. This is the face of the sun.
Okay.
The Romans would call it Sol Invictus.
The invincible sun.
Yes. And the rays around the side are the rays of the sun, and the dots are the eyes of the gods. This came from Baalbek, which was the center of Roman sun worship.
And sun worship was quite central in the Roman culture, right?
But see, Sean, we worship the S-O-N, not the S-U-N.
Ha! Excellent.
So they worship the sun that rose. I mean, this was quite prevalent in cultures before Israel came up against Rome. I think in the Canaanite cultures, there was honor to the sun. And it really, in every religion outside of Israel, it seemed that this was a major theme.
Well, yes, but see, that's why I wrote Revelation, was to bring light. And Jesus said it himself. He said, I'm the light of the world. And that's what it's all about. And see, it doesn't matter. See, this little clay one, that used to have a handle.
Okay, so this first one, that would have been an official lamp or something somebody with some money owned?
Oh, yes, either a temple or a very wealthy person.
Okay, now but this one might be more like what you had on Patmos.
Yeah, this is what and see, this one used to have a little handle right there, and it broke off.
All right.
And then this is expendable.
Okay.
And the Romans thought that some people were expendable, but see, Jesus says we're all valuable, more valuable than this, and this one's more of a Roman style.
Uh-huh.
And this is a little nicer, but it's clay. But yeah, I lived in a cave.
Well, yeah, tell me a little bit about Patmos. I mean, I have seen some pictures of Patmos. And I understand it to be not very big and really quite bleak. It's not a great place, is it? And this is where you are when you get the vision of Revelation.
Patmos was a very bleak place. I mean, we were out there away from everybody and everything, and that was the plan. It was a penal colony, and the Romans, they sent people there that they wanted to get rid of, and they took big rocks and beat them with hammers into little rocks. And but see, they didn't send me there first.
Okay. Tell me, I mean, this is something I'm curious about. I mean, you are today remembered as quite a central figure in Christianity. Absolutely. And you're remembered, well, almost in reverential terms. That's not even what, you're on a bit of a pedestal, and we don't often think about the fact that you're actually in prison on Patmos. You're a prisoner. You're not in a noble spot. You're in a horrible spot.
It was terrible. And see, Domitian, who was Caesar at the time,
right?
His older brother Titus was the one that destroyed Jerusalem in 70, and then his generals went down and took Masada, and but Domitian, when he came to the throne, he wanted to do away with the entire line of David.
Right. So is this his problem with you? You have a problem with the Roman emperor. What exactly is this problem? Because the Romans really were quite tolerant of most national religions.
But they weren't tolerant of Christianity, because you see, we were, and Jesus himself said that he was a king, he was going to set up a kingdom, and Domitian didn't, well, remember what Herod, he didn't want anyone contending for the kingship.
And of course, he worked for the Romans.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
And so now Domitian, he's against Christians because of that, and I'm of the line of David, so I had, he was, he tried to make me a French fry.
Oh, what do you mean by that?
He boiled me in oil.
You know, I think I have heard that historically. Horrible.
No, I recommend it.
How do you recommend being boiled in oil?
Well, it tightens up everything that's loose, and it loosens up everything that's tight. And see, what I learned, though, Sean, is this. Whatever the challenge is, whatever the challenge of evil that comes to your life, God can make it a good thing. And when they tried to boil me in oil and nothing happened, then they said, we don't know what to do with him. So that's when they sent me to Patmos. And as bleak as it was, that was a blessing too.
Wait a minute. The Romans send you to Patmos. Domitian has a problem with you. You had formerly held a very high position in the church in Ephesus and in Asia Minor, and you're in a prison, and yet you say, this is to God's glory and this is a good thing. Am I reading you right?
Yes, because see, where does light shine the brightest?
In the dark.
Yes. And so when evil tries to put you in the dark, that's when light shines the brightest. And so, see, they meant it for ill, but God turned it around and meant it for good. And see, when I got there, they said, how old are you? And I said, well, I'm 90. And they said, you're too old to work here. Just go find a cave someplace. And so I did, and I had time to pray, and I had time to think, and one day I was out walking, Mm-hmm. And I heard a trumpet behind me. It was loud. I almost jumped out of my sandals.
Ha. Huh.
And what would you do if you were out there in a quiet place and all of a sudden you hear this?
I would jump. I'd jump out of my skin.
And what else would you do?
I would have a look.
Yeah, well, that's what I did. I turned around.
Ha. Huh.
And see, that's the whole story.
I remember you writing that. It's here. We've broken your book into chapters and verses.
Oh.
And I turned, what is it? I was in the Spirit in verse 10 of chapter 1 on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice as of a trumpet. A little later you write, then I turned to see the voice that spoke with me. And having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. What else did you see?
One like the Son of Man. The golden lampstands, and he had white hair. And he was dressed like a priest.
Now, that's very interesting to me. Dressed like a priest. And that's a theme that comes up quite a bit in your book.
Well, sure, because Jesus is the high priest.
Right.
Over all eternity. And so all through the scroll that I wrote, Revelation, by the way, it's called the Revelation of Jesus.
Now, you know what I find interesting is that in modern day language, it's often titled right here, the Revelation of St. John the Divine. That's what they call you now.
Oh, no. It's not revealing me. It's revealing Jesus. See, I'm just like this lamp. The oil of the Spirit. But a lamp is no good unless there's a wick that comes out. And then that wick can be lit in the darkness and shed light. So it's a revelation of Jesus. That's what it's about.
Interesting. Now, I can see. I mean, as I listen to your enthusiasm about Jesus and your spirit about persecution. I mean, I'm listening to what you say here. Right in the early, you talked to the church back in Asia Minor. I, John, both your brother and companion in the tribulation and kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ. I mean, everybody's suffering. And here you are holding out hope. It is so easy for me to see why you're known as the beloved disciple.
Well, I wasn't always a beloved person at all. I mean, my brother and I had the people gave us a nickname. They called us Sons of Thunder because we would thunder around and we were always wanting to be the biggest and the best and the most important and well, I wasn't always too lovely to be around.
Well, you're remembered as the loving disciple, the kind disciple. That's sort of how we remember you today. So you're saying that wasn't always true?
No. In fact, here's something that Luke read. You realize when you get older, your arms get shorter.
Would you like to borrow my, these will help.
Well, let me try.
All right.
An argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, told a little child and brought him and stood him beside him. And then he said to them, whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes the one who sent me. He is the greatest. See, we were always arguing about who's the greatest. That's not very beloved. Master said, John, that's me, we saw a man driving out demons in your name and we tried to stop him because he wasn't one of us. See, there was this us and them.
Right.
Don't stop him, Jesus said. Whoever isn't against us is for us. And then this one. The time approached for him to be taken to heaven. And Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And he sent messengers ahead who went to a Samaritan village.
Right.
And to get things ready for him. And the people there didn't proclaim him because he was headed for Jerusalem. And then we wanted to call fire down from heaven.
Oh, boy. Just to destroy them.
Yeah.
Now, listen, obviously something changed you, and we're going to take a little break and come right back, and I'm going to ask you, what changes John the Son of Thunder to John the Beloved Disciple, the kind one that we remember? And just a little later, believe it or not, you're actually going to have a chance to ask John some of your questions. Here's what you need to know to join our discussion. Go to hopetv.org/disclosure. Look us up on YouTube. Visit us at Facebook. Call me at 888-730-HOPE. Send me a text message at 707-200-1099. You can send John a text message, 707-200-1099. Coming up next, back with more of John the Revelator. Welcome back. Remember, you can join our discussion here on Disclosure today by calling me at 888-730-HOPE or 4673. Send me or John the Revelator a text message, 707-200-1099. I'm on the web at hopetv.org/disclosure. I'm on Facebook. Look us up on Twitter, YouTube. My goodness, there is no excuse not to join the discussion tonight. I'm with John the Revelator. We've kind of bent the space-time continuum in our own special way and invited you on the program, and we've been talking about the fact that you were not always John the Beloved Disciple, the kind and gentle John. You were a son of thunder, and something changed you. John, what is it that changes you so profoundly?
The light of the world. Jesus changed me. Oh, lots of things changed me, but I mean, lots of things that he did, things that I saw him do, things I experienced with him, things that he helped us do. Jesus changed me. Jesus changes everybody.
Now, how does he change you? How does that process happen? Because there are a lot of people who wonder how what Jesus does for them. What does he do for you? How do you go through that change?
By observing what he did, by walking with him, and especially the last part of his life.
Now, I noticed that you and Matthew and Mark and Luke, you spend about half of your time talking about 3.5 years, but then you spend the other half of your time talking about 7 days. Those are the last days of Jesus' life here on earth. And you talk about the Last Supper and some of those things. What happens in that week that touches you so deeply?
Well, I mentioned to you about Domitian.
Right.
See, on his coins, he had written on his coins, Dominus et Deus.
Mm-hmm.
That's Lord and God. He was proclaiming himself to be Lord and God. Well, Sean, we were doing the same thing by our activities. We were saying, we're Lord, we're gods. And Jesus is trying to give us light that he's Lord and he's God.
So what are some of the specific things that happened in that last week that drive this point home for you?
Well, Peter, the oldest, and I, the youngest, were told to get the fellowship supper, the Passover supper, ready for Jesus and the rest of the disciples. And we got everything, well, almost everything ready. We didn't get people to wash our feet. And we were debating who's the greatest. And while we're debating, because see, that's the lowest of the low servant.
Right. No, it's not a custom we have anymore today because we wrap our feet in cloth. We call them socks and shoes. But your feet are right in the dust. And so somebody has to have a very humble position to clean those feet.
But none of us wanted to be a servant at all. And Peter, he's the oldest, and he kept pointing to me. And I'm the youngest because usually the youngest gets the dirty job. And I wasn't going to do it. And then suddenly Jesus took off his outer garment. And he knelt down and he began to wash our feet. He was telling us, if you want to be the greatest, you serve. And that began to come home to me. But what really did it was when he was on the cross and he said to me that I should take care of his mother.
Fascinating. I mean, that's not the normal behavior. There were a lot of crucifixions in your time. We sometimes forget that 2,000 years later, that it wasn't just Jesus. Crucifixion was very common, and most of the people who were crucified obviously didn't behave this way. This is quite unique, isn't it?
Jesus was always caring for people. It was always about him serving other people, him caring for other people. And that's the same today. He's the same Jesus. And yes, it was different because the thieves, they were caring for themselves and they were cursing and swearing, and Jesus was caring for us and caring for his mother.
Appointed you basically a custodian, a guardian to his own mother.
Yes.
That shows something of the trust he put in you guys as disciples in spite of the way you'd acted.
And that trust and that open honesty that the risk that he took started to change me, Sean. It started to change me. Well, he was changing little by little. See, it wasn't an instant change. It's little by little, step by step. At least that's the way it was for me.
Now, you were there. There are some things about that crucifixion week that have I've always wondered about. In John 18 and verse 15, in your gospel account, and the numbers, of course, are for a modern audience. They weren't there originally. We did that to help us sort our way through it. It talks about the fact that Simon Peter followed Jesus, so did another disciple. Now, that other disciple, I've always suspected that's you.
Well, it was, but see, I just put it that way because it's not about me, it's about Jesus.
Okay, and I've noticed Mark does that in another case too. I've always suspected some of the people he doesn't name by name are the author. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Now, that disciple was known to the high priest and went with Jesus into the courtyard. John, how did you get into the courtyard with the high priest? How did you sneak through?
Well, I didn't have to sneak through. I mean, see, I had studied to be a priest. Let me go back. See, my mother and father and our family, we were of the line of David, so we were respected because of that. And we were fairly well-to-do. We had boats, plural.
Yeah.
We had servants, plural. And so I grew up, well, relatively well-to-do. And see, my goal was to be a priest and even to be the high priest, because then people would say, ooh, there goes John, the high priest. And so I studied with them. So they knew me. When I came to the gate, they knew me. And they said, oh, John, come on in. And I said, this fellow here is with me, too. I didn't dare name him after he cut off the ear of Malchus.
For sure, yeah.
And see, I'm the only one that puts Malchus' name in the story.
Interesting.
Because I knew the people.
Ah, so you had touched, you know, I think I remember reading this in the writings of Eusebius, one of the early Christians after your time, mentioned that you had studied for the priesthood, for the sacerdotal plate.
Yes.
Interesting stuff. You get inside because you're in the priestly line. You're from a well-to-do family, and I find all of this fascinating because when Jesus appears to you in Revelation in the first chapter, he's in priestly garb.
Yes.
He's dressed like a priest.
Yes.
This is language that speaks not just to your mind, but to your whole being.
Yes, yes. And that's a theme all through the scroll, all through the revelation of Jesus, that he is the priest. He's the one who does it all.
Well, the next time you mention seeing Jesus, though, he's not dressed as a priest anymore. It's over in Revelation chapter 5, and we read this here on the program a few weeks ago, and you describe him in verse 6 of chapter 5 of Revelation. And I looked, and behold, in the midst of the throne, the four living creatures, in the midst of the elders, stood a lamb as though it had been slain. That had to have impact on you because you were there at the crucifixion, weren't you?
Talk about being slain. It was the worst way to die ever. Painful, despicable, terrible. The lamb was slain. I saw him slain. I was there.
What's crucifixion like?
It's brutal. See, Jesus first, when Pilate had him whipped, the people were screaming for blood, and Pilate said, essentially, if you want blood, here, let's whip him. We'll show you blood. And then he said, behold the man, ecce homo. Isn't that enough?
Behold the man, ecce homo. Latin.
And then when the crowd kept crying and screaming and hollering, and they condemned Jesus to be crucified, part of the procedure was a whipping, so he was whipped again. And that whip was not just leather.
It's not like a willow switch.
Oh, no. It's got metal embedded in it, and it would just shred your skin and leave your whole back just raw. And then they nailed him to a cross.
You have some of those Roman nails with you.
They're terrible. The long nail was for the feet. They'd bend the knees, and then they would drive this through both arches in your feet. And then the shorter ones would go right there.
Interesting. A lot of art I've seen puts it here, but that doesn't make sense.
Well, to the Romans, anything from here down was the hand.
Right. So not through the palm.
Oh, right there.
Through the wrist.
And it's not just because it won't pull out, because there's cartilage here, but right in the middle is a median nerve that controls your hand. And the square nail is made square so that when you split that nerve, any motion makes your whole arm feel like it's on fire.
Mm.
And then to breathe, you have to pull on the nails and stand on the nail in the feet, and your raw back rubs up and down against that rough wood. It's terrible.
Jesus spoke in that condition, didn't he? And there's something interesting. He doesn't speak very long. His sentences are short.
He only has one breath. I mean, it's excruciating. You know the word.
It's Latin, ex from the cross, yes. Out of the cross.
So the pain of just taking a breath and then speaking and dropping back down is terrible. The lamb was slain. I was there.
After that crucifixion, you guys were hiding.
Oh, we were terrified. We were afraid. We were hiding in the upper room. We didn't know where else to go. We were terrified.
Why? I mean, Jesus is gone now. Isn't the problem solved?
See, number one, the light of the world for us went out. It was dark. We didn't know what to do. We didn't know what to think. And what we thought was, if they did that to Jesus, what will they do to us? Because Jesus was popular with the people.
So as you're there in hiding, how long does that last?
Well, it seemed to last forever. And then early in the morning.
Oh, man, I'm jumping now.
Our hearts almost stop because we don't want anybody to even know where we are and knocking on the door and making noise. It's like, shh, quiet, don't. And it was the women saying, let us in.
And the women say?
Jesus isn't in the tomb. The tomb is empty.
All right. You're in hiding. You saw this horrible death for Christ. And you get the word that the tomb is empty. We're going to have to take a break, and in just a moment, I want you to tell me what you discovered, and then we're going to let people have a chat with you and ask some questions. We're going to take that short break, but don't forget to send us your questions. You can text them to me at 707-200-1099 or call and talk with John at 888-730-HOPE. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on YouTube. You can tweak your questions in. It's hopetv.org/disclosure. I'm going to be back in just a moment with more of John the Revelator. And we're back with John the Revelator on Disclosure. John, we've been talking. In a few moments, we're going to let people call in. This will blow your mind. It's an expression we have now. People are from across the country and around the world are able to talk to us, yeah, through the miracle of modern technology. But before we get to that, I don't want to leave the story untold. The tomb is empty, the women tell you. You run down to the tomb, and what do you find?
Well, I found myself going back to my old priestly training. I got to the edge of the tomb and looked in, and I was younger. I beat Peter there. and I stopped right at the entrance because I didn't want to go in.
Why not? Why don't you go into the tomb?
Well, it would be ceremonially unclean, and I was still concerned
because
about it.
Because there was a dead body inside. Sure.
And so Peter came, and he goes right in, and he said...
That sounds like Peter.
Oh, yeah, Peter. And he said, John, come in. You've got to come in here. And I did. And, Sean, what I saw was so exciting. See, not only was the tomb empty. Well, it wasn't empty. The tomb wasn't empty.
And what was in the tomb?
Well, Jesus wasn't in the tomb. The body wasn't in the tomb. But the grave cloths, they were still there. But they weren't just dumped. They were folded.
Now, why do you emphasize that?
Because in my culture, if you go to a big meal,
right,
and the food is really good, and you want more, and you get up, you don't want somebody to take your place, and so you take your napkin and you fold it carefully, and that says, "I'm not finished. I'm coming back." If you're finished, you just wad it up and dump it, and that's it.
But and of course, the last thing that Jesus does with you is have a meal, and he tells you, "I will not eat with you again until I do it in the kingdom."
Yes, and he reinforced that by leaving the folded grave cloths. He said, "It's not over."
But it's more than that. You actually saw Jesus, didn't you?
Oh, yes. I saw the resurrected Jesus, the light of the world. The light of the world didn't go out. The light of the world, see, that's what Revelation's about. The light of the world still burns, and he's coming back. And we'll have that meal with him, the celebration. See, that's why I'm so excited that Patmos wasn't just a rock. It was a blessing.
It's mind-boggling. Of course that would change it. I'm starting to get it. You see what he does. He is the ultimate servant. He gives his life. So Patmos seems like light duty by comparison.
And you use the word servant. Yeah. See, when I started giving the revelation.
Well, you say this, don't you? Right in the beginning.
Yes. You've read it.
I've read it. It's chapter 1 and verse 1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants the things which must shortly take place, and he sent and signified it by his angel to his
servant,
John.
That's the highest title anyone could carry.
Remarkable.
And I fought it. I fought it until I really understood what it was to be a servant.
Paul wrote, "Let this mind be in you which was in Christ Jesus." It's in Philippians chapter 2. Who in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equal with God, yet made himself a servant. The path to greatness is through servanthood.
I finally got it. Yes, I did. See, Jesus said so many things. He said, I've shown you these things so that when it comes to pass, you'll understand, you'll believe. And it took a while, but we did believe. And yes, being a servant, that's where it is.
It's a long book, and I'd love to ask you about every little detail, and there are some people waiting to ask you some questions, but what's the main point? What's the main point of your book?
That Jesus is the light. Dominus et Deus is not an emperor, not someone who puts pressure. It's Jesus. He's the light of the world. And he wants me, and he wants you, and he wants everyone to be a servant. That's what it's about.
John wrote a remarkable story, and there are some people waiting to ask you some things. This would blow your mind, I think. We have a device where someone on the other side of the planet can send a question. They write it with their thumb, and it comes through the air and lands here. Oh, it's remarkable. Text messaging. It's not only a remarkable way to communicate, it also takes away every last bit of freedom you have because it goes off all day long. But here's the question that comes in from Micah. In verse 3, now we broke your book into chapters and verses right at the beginning. What did you mean when you said, "Blessed are those who hear the words of this prophecy"? That's right in Revelation 1 and verse 3, for those who are following along in an English Bible, "Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it." What does it mean, "Blessed are those who hear the words of the prophecy"?
Well, most people didn't have, what do you call that, a book?
Yeah, in Latin, codex, but we call it a book in English.
See, all we had were scrolls, and so not everybody had a copy, and so it would be read to the churches. It was sent out. And people would read it. So the blessing is on people who read it, but what's the rest of it say there? Not only read it, but...
Blessed are they who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things.
Ah, so see, it's not just hearing it, it's keeping it, it's doing it. See, we had a lot of people in my day, they believed if you just knew, gnosko, we called them Gnostics, if you just know something, you just hear it, that's good enough.
We have some Gnostics to this day. It's all about what you know up here.
But it's what we do, and it's who we know.
Well, you know, this kind of reminds me. My mother used to say, "Do you hear me, Sean?" And she didn't mean, did my words go into your ear? She meant, do you understand? Are you going to follow through on this?
My mother said the same thing.
All right, we have Brittany, who has submitted a question by YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah. YouTube. I'm not even going to try to explain YouTube to you, but you're about to see it. Brittany is going to send her image through the air and ask her question. Go ahead, Brittany, with your question for John the Revelator.
Revelation 10:4 mentions seven thunders speaking, but what they say isn't written down. Why not?
Well, you know, Brittany, that's always bugged me too. You're right in there. I think it's in Revelation 10, she said. I think she's right too. Verse 4, when the seven thunders uttered their voices, I was about to write, but I heard a voice from heaven. So you never tell us what they say. Why?
Well, Because it's the voice from heaven said, don't say anything.
Well, I guess that's true, isn't it?
But you see, I put it down because, I mean, you know, about the seven thunders, I had to at least write it down because, see, I was known as son of
thunder.
Thunder. So, I mean, you know, it just seemed right to say that I heard the thunders. I mean, and there's something
Slipped
else, too,
yeah.
Sean, with this. See, this scroll, the signs and the symbols there have meaning to the Romans as well. And thunder was one of those super signs.
Okay.
So it speaks to everybody in every culture.
Right. To them, it's an omen. I'm gonna pick that thought up in just a moment because we have to take another short break. We'll come back and answer more of your questions. We'll take calls, text messages, social media questions. Look us up at hopetv.org/disclosure. Text me your question. Text John your question. Don't go anywhere, though, because we're about to come right back and finish our discussion, if you can believe it, with John, who wrote the book of Revelation. We're back with John the Revelator, and you were just talking about thunders and earthquakes and how a Roman audience could understand what you were saying, especially as well as a Hebrew audience.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes.
So these are omens. Romans would pay attention to this stuff. My name is Elma. This is an email, another form of communication we've got. Now, I know. You sit at a box. This is in Chicago. This is a long journey on foot, many days. But we can do it in about 2 hours on an airplane through the air. Yeah, I know. My name is Alma. I'm from Chicago. My question, how can John aspire to be a priest if he's a descendant of David? Wasn't David from the line of Judah? Didn't God say that only the descendants of Levi were supposed to be priests? I thought that's why Levites were not given a piece of land when they entered the Promised Land, and when did that change?
Well, that's true. But see, in my day, in the first century, what had happened is the priesthood became something of a popularity contest, and if you were wealthy enough, you could buy into the priesthood. It wasn't right. See, that's it. People trying to find their own way. Caiaphas and
right.
his whole family.
Right.
I mean, they bought the priesthood. And so I aspired to that too. See, that's the difference. Being a servant means you serve where God puts you. You don't try to scratch your way or buy your way to the top. So really, in a way, while Dominus et Deus was written on the coins, and while we say Judas was a betrayer, maybe there's more than one way to betray someone too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if all of us are honest and look at that slain lamb you write about in Revelation, I mean, when you're standing there in that throne room, I remember the scene, who is worthy, and you break down in tears. I think if any of us were there, we'd have to admit we'd have to have the same reaction. We've all betrayed him at some level or other, just by virtue of the fact that we have broken our relationship with our Creator and have sinned.
Yes, and we walk in darkness. That's why he's the light. He's the one that brings light and life. And in a way, we all become priests. It's not restricted. Jesus opens the doors, like he opened in the Revelation. He opened the doors for us to see into the eternal temple, if you will.
Well, John, let me pick up my digital scroll. I know that doesn't make any sense either, but I can hold millions of scrolls in this one little box. And this box is telling me that we have another YouTube question from Erica for you about your book, Revelation. This is Erica on YouTube.
Daniel's prophecy has a lot in common with Revelation's prophecy, yet Daniel's own was sealed and Revelation's own was ordered not to be sealed. Why the difference?
Oh, you know what? There's actually a couple of questions there. And Erica, if you don't mind, I'm going to expand on that a little bit because I think there's two parts in there. You do have a lot in common with Daniel, don't you? And,
yes.
You have a lot in common with a lot of books of the Bible in Revelation.
Well, the scrolls, the symbols that were used in Revelation, most of them came right out of the old scrolls. And the language, because it's a thread that goes all the way through all of what's been written.
Okay, so the language, if we really want to understand Revelation, we got to read the rest of the Scriptures, because you're dipping into the rest of Scripture to describe what you're being shown.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Because it all goes together. It's one. There are different ways of saying it. And even in writing, what I did, you know, I would make a point, and then I would come around, and I'd make the point again, and I'd come around and make the point again, and you find that in all the scrolls. That's the way we write. You don't get it all at once. You get it piece by piece. It's repetition.
And Daniel, now Erica's question, I was a little selfish, Erica, dipping into your question that way, but she asks, why is Daniel sealed? And your book at the end says, don't seal this.
Because read just a little bit further. It says, because the time is near.
Right. The time is at hand. The time is near.
And Daniel wrote, the time wasn't near.
This will be for many days, it said.
Yes. But when it was revealed to me, the time is near, and that's why it's so exciting.
All right. We touched on what you said in Revelation chapter 1, and I think we've got Jill from Kentucky on the phone with a question about Revelation 1:10. I think I've got your question right. Jill, are you there tonight? Can I hear you?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Jill, how's the weather in Kentucky?
Oh, it's beautiful.
Now, well, pay attention, John. We're speaking through the air to a place hundreds of miles away. Hey, listen, Jill, what's your question for John the Revelator tonight?
Well, I was wondering, in chapter 1 and verse 10, it speaks about, on the Lord's day, I was in the Spirit. And in some translations, it refers back to Acts chapter 20 and verse 7, and that refers to on the first day of the week.
All right. Well, that's a great question. Let's pitch that one to John. Thank you, Jill. You say on the Lord's Day. In my day and age, we wrestle with what the Lord's Day is. What's that? What's your understanding as you're writing in the first century?
Well, first of all, every day belongs to the Lord, because He created every day. I mean, that's what we have in the scrolls that Moses wrote in creation. But the Lord's Day was also a common term that was used in the Roman periods for the day that was to venerate Caesar.
Right.
And you know, Dominus et Deus, Lord and God.
Right.
And so these were holidays, there were many of them, where you were supposed to show obedience to the ruler. And here comes the revelation that says, no, it's not about the ruler, it's about the ruler of the universe.
Now, in your first century context, the Lord's Day, if you and Jesus are having a talk and you studied for the priesthood, is there any question in a Hebrew mind in the first century what that day is?
Well, that day would be Sabbath.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, and I think that's one of the important points, is to read Revelation not in a modern context, but in the context you wrote it in. I mean, you wrote it with the Hebrew Scriptures in mind and using that symbolism.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, well, we've got time for, we can sneak one in if we're really quick. We've got a text message again. You describe Jesus as one like the Son of Man, from Rebecca. Why do you describe Him that way? Why do you describe Jesus as one like the Son of Man?
Well, first off, that's right out of Ezekiel's scrolls.
Right.
Son of Man. But also, it's a way of saying that Jesus was real. Jesus was human. Jesus felt the nails. He felt the whip.
We've got only seconds left, John. And I want to ask you one last question. Just seconds. If you had it to do all over again, would you follow Jesus?
Absolutely. He's the light of the world. He's the light of my life. Absolutely. I couldn't do anything other than follow Jesus. And that's why following Him and witnessing for Him and being a servant is the greatest thing.
Somebody's struggling right now. In this country, a lot of people are out of work. It's a tough time. In just a few words, what would you want them to get from your book?
Jesus is the light of the world, and Jesus wants you to follow Him and to be His servant, and He'll be with you every step of the way. He was with me on Patmos. He was with me even when I was walking away from Him, and He'll never walk away from you.
John, what a delight to cross the centuries and spend a few minutes with you. That's all the time we've got. Next Thursday, some people say the crucifixion was predicted centuries before it happened. Was it really? Don't you go away. I'll be back with a few more thoughts on John and the book of Revelation. You know, it can be pretty easy to get lost in the powerful symbols used by the prophetic books of the Bible. Daniel sees incredible beasts coming up out of the sea, one after the other. Ezekiel sees angels and lightning and the throne of God. John sees the living creatures and the plagues and cosmic battle and angels circling the globe. Sometimes it's easy to lose track of the main idea. The book of Revelation, according to the opening verse, is a revelation of Jesus himself. It's not really about the beast or the dragon or the plagues, even though those things do form an important part of the message. At the heart of the book is a slain lamb in the throne room of God, and that lamb takes the scroll out of the Father's hand and moves our planet closer and closer to the day when his own kingdom replaces our own miserable, failed attempt at ruling ourselves. This is not a book that ends with death and destruction. It's a book that ends with light, and in that light is life. It's a book that ends with you in the presence of God forever. My favorite passage in the Bible is found in the closing words that John wrote in the book of Revelation. "I heard a loud voice from heaven saying," he writes, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things are passed away. Then he who sat on the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, Write, for these words are true and faithful." Just try to imagine what those words might have meant to an aging disciple banished to a rocky prison in the middle of the sea. So far, the words of the Bible, its prophecies, have proven to be absolutely faithful. For thousands of years, everything has happened right on schedule, exactly as predicted, and God has more than proven his ability to keep his word. If God says it, you can take it to the bank, John says. The pain, the suffering, the tears, the death, it all comes to an end. You can count on it because it's real. All that other stuff, all those other prophecies, they're there to help you realize that it really is going to happen. It verifies that God knows where he's taking us. It's really going to come. And if God says you can have a place in his kingdom, bank on it. Go ahead. Write it down. It's as real as all those other prophecies. And the only thing left for you at this moment is to come to terms with Jesus. What reason could anybody possibly have to refuse the offer of the Lamb who gave his life at the cross of Calvary? Forgiveness is as guaranteed as the prophecies. I'm Sean Boonstra, and today you've been watching Disclosure.